content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good day to you all. This is Joe Austin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Legal Matters. For the next half hour, we'll explore topics, help you champion your legal rights so that you can obtain equal access and full participation in our community and achieve your goals of independent living. In today's episode, our guest is Chris Hodgson. Chris, hello.
Hello, Joe. Good to be here.
We're glad to have you, Chris. Chris Hodgson is an attorney with Disability Rights North Carolina, and we're very excited to have him today. And our subject is going to be labor and employment law. And Chris is one of the labor and employment law experts, professionals at Disability Rights North Carolina. Well, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a little background, a little biography, and how you came to be at Disability Rights North Carolina.
Well, I'm originally from Illinois, central Illinois. And I think anybody who ends up at Disability Rights North Carolina has some connection to disability that happens in their life. Mine was mostly spending all my 20s working as a service provider and working in that industry for people with disabilities. Spent quite a bit of time getting to know lots of people with disabilities and just understanding the value and dignity of their life, as well as ultimately becoming kind of uncomfortable with the custodial model of services that were being provided to them, which ended up leading me into to law school, and then that led me to eventually Disability Rights North Carolina.
Well, we're glad to have you here in Raleigh with this fine organization. And tell us a little bit about what you do with Disability Rights, Chris. What is your area of expertise? And tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I'm part of our community inclusion team, and we are kind of broken up into the various teams at Disability Rights North Carolina. We mostly end up enforcing all aspects of the ADA, Title 1, 2, and 3. And so that Title 1 is employment, Title 2 is really government and government services, and Title 3 is places of public accommodation. Then just as within that, my first, 3 or 4 years at Disability Rights North Carolina, I spent a lot of time focusing in on employment and how employment services are delivered to people with disabilities throughout North Carolina.
So, remind me, how long have you been with Disability Rights?
I've been there since, this would be fall 2015.
Okay, so going on 6 years. And prior to our show today, I had an opportunity to take a look at your organization's website, particularly regarding employment rights. And I've got to commend and recommend those to our audience. If they covered these things on the bar examination, doggone it, you could pass the bar exam. They're so good. Well done. Let's say that I have had an issue. Maybe I've showed up at for an interview, a job interview, and the employer has asked me about my disability. Let's assume that it is a manifest disability. What are the legalities of inquiring about disabilities in a job interview, Chris?
Well, it's not something that normally the employer should approach. If the person discloses it, then that's And then certainly you can follow up and ask some questions about the nature of your disability. Do you think you'll be able to meet the job requirements? And, you know, if it's obvious that you have a disability when you walk in, then, you know, that could lead to some questions. But those questions shouldn't be really geared into how severe your disability is. It shouldn't feel like a medical examination at all. It should, if they're asking any questions, it really has to do with, you know, can you job, you know, with your disability, and the questioning should stop once you say yes.
So it really boils down to what are the essential functions of the job. Is that right?
Yeah, that's kind of the legal term that goes into it, is kind of figuring out what are minor job tasks versus what are essential job tasks. And, you know, each job has some tasks that are quite minor, that not everybody necessarily needs to do. And some things, you know, some parts of a job are absolutely essential. You know, if your job is to drive a taxi, then, you know, you're going to have to know how to drive. But, you know, there might be very minor tasks that are related to that job that you don't necessarily need to perform just to do that job. And the law very much distinguishes between what are those minor job tasks versus what are the essential ones.
I'm glad you brought up the driving, because that has become somewhat of a hot topic in the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. And under what circumstances could an employer legitimately say that the ability to drive is an essential function of the job? I mean, suppose I come to my interview, I've got a service animal. It's obvious that I've got a cane. So that's how I navigate through the office. And at what point is the ability to drive an essential function, and when is it not? And that's a loaded question, because there's a lot of case law on that. But give our listeners some more information that will make that a little bit more intuitive.
Courts have mostly said around this issue is that it's very fact specific, and, you know, you'd want to look at how much self is driving. What is the core part of the job? So I mentioned a taxi driver. Like, a taxi driver drives. That's what you do. That goes to the heart of what that job's about. If you're doing a different job, let's say you're a counselor who happens to, you know, have a job where they've got to do a lot of travel part of that job. Well, job is your high, you know, and then it becomes accommodation that will allow you to meet travel.
Yeah. Okay, just to we were talking about driving as an essential function, and you know, when is it an essential function and when is it not? And do you feel like you had addressed that, Chris, or you want to pick, but you got any other thoughts about that?
Well, just so, and it's all kind of related. So if the core of the job itself is driving, then that's going to be essential. But if travel is really what's required for the job, then what you end up asking is really not whether driving is essential, but whether or not an accommodation is going to work to where, mm-hmm. you know, travel is part of that job that you can get that you can get from A to B. So then you really enter into the world of accommodations rather than deciding whether the job is essential. So the way essential job requirements work and accommodations work is often hand in hand. So once something's decided that it's not essential, and kind of the next follow-up question is, well, do I have an accommodation that will allow me to do that task?
And still on the topic of driving, I know that you know, there's been some cases on that, and the I know in one case you may be familiar, you probably are familiar with it, Stevenson versus Pfizer Inc. The plaintiff was a high powered pharmaceutical salesperson, and the question boiled down to and could not drive anymore, but she sure could sell, and it came down to a question of whether the employer had to find or provide a driver for that person. Now, under what circumstances would something like that be that an accommodation like that be reasonable, do you think?
That was a particularly good case because I think you could probably draw a very clear connection between how much money this person was potentially making for the company versus how much, you know, an accommodation would cost. You know, I think a lot of times when a driver is going to end up being required, you almost likely the employer is going to say, well, that's going to be an undue burden. It might cost too much. And you're going to end up into a situation where you're analyzing it that way. But in terms of just, you know, whether it's reasonable, it's gonna be fairly fact specific, and it's going to depend on how much value you're bringing to the company, likely, in those types of situations. The Stevenson case ended up saying that really this is not a thing that a judge can decide, and we're going to send this to the jury and let the jury decide whether or not this is a reasonable accommodation. And so I would expect that in a lot of these types of situations, that's what's going to happen, is just the judges aren't going to decide these on their own. They're going to leave it to the juries to decide what's reasonable when the evidence has all been presented to them.
Any idea that the last time I took a look at that case was about 2017, and I knew that the Fourth Circuit had remanded that case back to the district court for jury trial. Do you know how that came out? Any idea?
I believe it was settled after that between the parties.
I was going to say.
I don't think a jury ended up deciding the factual issue.
I was going to say, I mean, most of the time, big employer like that, bigger you are, the bigger target you are, and wants to try to maintain some control over the outcome, and they'll settle up. That's a very interesting case. And one of the issues that I think was is incorporated into that very excellent synopsis that you gave us, Chris, is undue hardship. And how does that work into the assessment of a reasonable accommodation?
Well, it's a different assessment. A reasonable accommodation ends up being something that the employee needs to show, that in kind of the normal circumstances, this would be a reasonable accommodation. And then an undue hardship is really specific to the employer, where they might say the court, or I guess the law says, okay, so this is reasonable under most circumstances, but there might be some particular reason why this is really tough on this employer. And that ends up being a defense that the employer can raise, and they have to prove that, you know, this is a real hardship on us. And because of that, we can't provide this accommodation. But that's where it legally it breaks up there between what the employee has to show, which is just like, this is a reasonable accommodation, versus what the employer then can try to prove as a defense that, okay, it's reasonable, but this is really, really hard on us.
Cost too much.
Cost too much. It will change the way we do things in a real substantial way that's going to impact us significantly.
Yeah, money, that's what it's all about. But that last point that you made, I think, is very important, because we've had a sea change in sociologically in the last year. with regard to attitudes and philosophies toward telework. Have you had to confront or encounter that issue any in your practice?
I haven't directly had that situation. I know exactly what you're talking about. A lot of the remote work cases, people were not winning before COVID.
Right.
And there's a lot of case law out there that basically, you know, employers, if they've been requiring everybody to go into work, then they don't have to change that. What makes, you know, the COVID and this pandemic so interesting is the fact that so many employers have had to go through the process of creating a system to where employees can work remotely. And I think it's going to be much harder for them to say it's not reasonable and it's an undue burden when so many of these employers have gone through the process of establishing how we do it and making it a priority over this, you know, last year. So I expect that going forward, that's going to be an area where it's going to be more favorable to employees based off of the fact that so many employers have had to go through the process of making their work function with employees working remotely.
And, you know, it has occurred to me that getting back to that trope of money, they're going to look at their income statements and see that the cost of doing business may have been curtailed quite a bit by people working remotely, and they might fall in love with telework.
I think that's absolutely true. I think we're going to find that working in, I mean, it's less office space that you're having to pay. And there's ways to ensure that people are productive at home. It's not like, I think there's always been that fear that, oh, people are working at home, they're not going to be as productive. But there are absolutely ways to measure that. And, you know, quite honestly, when people aren't traveling and that's not an added expense, it makes it much easier to get work done. And, I think a lot of the rationale between, behind why remote work isn't doable, that's what's going to be harder for employers to say isn't doable because of this last year.
Right, and there will be some empirical information on that. There will be data that can be brought to bear on that issue. And one thing that occurred to me that, you know, we talked about. You can't ask people about their disability, et cetera. But if I have a manifest disability, it is fair for the employer to ask, well, you've got a job history. Were you accommodated in the past? How were you accommodated? Is that legal?
It's not. So they can't really delve into really what type of accommodations you need to do the job. Well, they can ask if you need accommodations to the job, and then I think it has to basically stop at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't start making assumptions about you and those types of things, but they can, you know, if it is, you know, if you have an obvious disability, they can ask, you know, can you do these job requirements on your own, or do you need some assistance and accommodations? Then it should really stop at that point.
And that's where the interactive process comes in, doesn't it?
Well, the interactive process comes in after a person with a disability has requested an accommodation.
Okay.
So it's not really, you know, there's really no duty on the employer to start the accommodation process. It's the employee's responsibility to start the accommodation process. And then what's called the interactive process really starts kicking in.
Go ahead.
Just to explain the interactive process is if I'm a the accommodation process is not really intuitive. If I'm an employee and I request an accommodation, the employer has to consider it, and they can decide, okay, we can provide this, or they can say, okay, we're not going to provide this. If they say that they're not going to provide it, they also have to consider alternative accommodations. And so then they should come back and not just say, we can't do this, but they should come back and say, and then there should be a conversation between employee and employer about, are there other accommodations that would work? And that really gets into the interactive process. It's kind of a duty of good faith on both sides to work through the process and find out what works.
Right. And one issue that caveat that you brought up it's addressed in your organization website materials is standing up for your rights at work. That is very true, isn't it? That the individual has to take responsibility for his or her rights at work, and the law requires some initiative. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely right. You don't want to wait to fail at work. You want to get what you need to be successful and to flourish. And if that means that you need an accommodation, then it's important to start that process. And there are legal protections around that process. They do have a duty to try to find the right accommodation for you. Now I should say that they don't have to give you the exact accommodation that you've asked for. They can always provide an alternative accommodation, but if they do so, it has to meet your disability-related needs. They can't offer you an accommodation that ultimately isn't going to help you do your job.
It's got to be a reasonable accommodation.
It's got to be reasonable, and it's got to meet your needs.
Right.
And that's really, if somebody's just offering you an alternative accommodation that's not going to allow you to do your job, then they haven't provided you an accommodation that's sufficient under the law.
Well, I've said this before on this program, and I'm going to say it again, and our listeners will probably in the future hear me say this again, but I'm very much prejudiced in favor of having a lawyer when there are legal issues involved. But here again, your materials are excellent. You've even got a sample letter for requesting a reasonable accommodation, a fill-in-the-blank letter. I read it. It's excellent. Under what circumstances at what point would you say, go on, deploy self-help, or you need to have legal counsel for something like this? Is there any magic point in time that you would call that?
The truth is having a lawyer, it requires resources and access to lawyers. So I think you want to have information about how the process is supposed to work so that you have an understanding of, if they come back and tell me, well, I'm not giving you this accommodation, but I'm going to give you this other accommodation, that you have an understanding of how the law works. If you have that understanding of how the law works, then you're in a good spot. And the way the employment works is that there is a informal process, an administrative process through the EOC that you can bring a complaint that's basically created to where you don't have to have an attorney. So the time where you absolutely have to have an attorney is once you've got a right to sue letter that tells you, you've got X amount of days to file a case. Because at that point, you're either going to have to drop it or you're going to have certain amount of days to file a case. And And then if you don't have an attorney, you'd have to do it on your own, which is a very tough process.
And of course,
so it's one of those things where having an attorney is very helpful, but the reality of it is that the process, and particularly the EOC process, is supposed to be employee friendly, and it's not a process where you have to have an attorney.
And of course, they can call Disability Rights North Carolina, 877-235-4210. And locally, 919-856-2195. If they've got, if our listeners have an employment issue, should they ask for you, Chris, or what should they do to get some help with disability rights?
So we have people who answer when the questions come in. They will go ahead and speak with individuals and get back to them. And then it kind of depends on what level of resources we're providing. So if what we're providing is legal information, then the people who call you back are the ones that you're going to interact with. So calling me is not going to do you much good. Where I would come in is when there's been a decision from Disability Rights North Carolina that we're going to take a case and we're going to provide direct representation for this individual. Otherwise, I'm pretty behind the scenes, just providing legal information when it's needed.
And remind our listeners what the cost is to call Disability Rights North Carolina.
It will cost you nothing. We are federally funded, and it's one of our core services is to provide legal information as well as legal advocacy for people with disabilities.
And when you actually take a case, I mean that you don't take the case doesn't mean you won't disseminate advice, right? I mean, you counsel people as well, or somebody does.
Correct. So that's when I mentioned legal information. Anybody who calls is going to be provided legal information if it's one of our target areas, and employment is certainly a target area for us. So you're going to be provided with some information about how to proceed with your issue. Legal representation is just kind of the next level up, which is when we have time to take on a case and we're going to be directly representing. But even if we can't represent somebody, you're going to receive some sort of legal information.
Well, that's great information, Chris. Our guest today was Chris Hodgson with Disability Rights North Carolina. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. That was very informative, very, very good program. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed the show and that it's revealed information about your legal rights, which will help you obtain equal access and full participation in our community. I'm Joe Austin for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Legal Matters is available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you so much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.